Today is Thursday, October 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris verbally sparred in Wednesday night's vice presidential debate.
The American people have witnessed what is the greatest failure of any presidential administration in the history of our country.
And again, the American people deserve to know Joe Biden opposed President Trump's decision to suspend all travel from China.
We have a full wrap of the contest and more next. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and California Senator Kamala Harris, the Democratic Party's vice presidential nominee, faced off Wednesday night in a debate in Salt Lake City, Utah. Michael Sullivan reports the administration's handling of COVID-19 loomed large as President Donald Trump and others in the White House remain in quarantine after contracting the virus.
A wide-ranging debate, overshadowed by news the President and First Lady and others in the White House have tested positive for COVID-19. Trump's response to the virus has been disastrous, said Harris.
The American people have witnessed what is the greatest failure of any presidential administration in the history of our country.
Not so, said Pence, who noted Trump limited travel from China, epicenter of the virus, slowing its spread in late January.
And again, the American people deserve to know Joe Biden opposed President Trump's decision to suspend all travel from China.
Pence said Trump ramped up testing and pushed for a vaccine. Harris questioned Trump's aggressive timetable to develop a vaccine.
If the doctors tell us that we should take it, I'll be the first in line to take it. Absolutely. But if Donald Trump tells us that we should take it, I'm not taking it.
Pence responded,
stop playing politics with people's lives. The reality is that we will have a vaccine, we believe, before the end of this year.
The pandemic has left the economy struggling, but Harris said the problem started before the virus struck.
Because of a so-called trade war with China, America lost 300,000 manufacturing jobs.
Again, not so, said Pence.
Lost the trade war with China. Joe Biden never fought it. Joe Biden has been a cheerleader for communist China through over the last several decades.
An issue for both sides is Trump's nomination of conservative Judge Amy Coney Barrett to fill the Supreme Court seat left vacant by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The job of vice presidential candidates is to avoid mistakes that will harm their running mates, says political scientist Andra Gillespie of Emory University.
And I think that they largely succeeded in doing no harm. Now, Vice President Pence is in a different position because he's part of the incumbent administration. And so he has to answer for the failures and the successes of the Trump administration.
Analyst Rich Marr of Randolph-Macon College says this debate was especially important in this election.
People don't vote for vice presidents, they vote for presidents. But this year it's different. You have the oldest candidates ever. You've got one candidate who is the incumbent, the president, who's been diagnosed with a really serious disease.
And either vice presidential candidate must be ready to assume the role of president if the president dies in office or is unable to fill his duties. It's a somber responsibility on the minds of many voters who are already casting ballots and early voting in some states. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
The next presidential debate is scheduled to take place next week. The Commission on Presidential Debates, which organizes the contest, on Thursday announced that the format was to be a virtual town hall event with participants at different locations instead of gathering at one venue. The Biden campaign said the former vice president would participate in the event, but President Trump told Fox Business Network's Mornings with Maria that the format was unacceptable and that he wasn't going to participate.
No, I'm not going to waste my time on a virtual debate. That's not what debating's all about. You sit behind a computer and do a debate. It's ridiculous. And then they cut you off.
Vice President Joe Biden said that he's going to follow the recommendations of the debate commission on how to proceed after Trump suggested he would have a rally instead of attending the debate. Facebook on Wednesday tightened ad restrictions ahead of U.S. elections next month because of mounting alarm that unfounded claims of voter fraud online could result in violence. Reuters reporter Libby Hogan has the details.
Facebook took new steps on Wednesday to bat down worries around its platform and the US election. The company says it's banned any calls for people to watch polling sites that use militarized language or that, quote, suggests that the goal is to intimidate, exert control, or display power over election officials or voters. Republicans have mobilized thousands of volunteers to watch polls for evidence backing up President Donald Trump's unproven complaints about voter fraud. Voting rights activists are concerned encounters at polling stations could escalate in a tense year that has already seen armed militias face off against protesters in some cities, much of which has been organized on social networks. Despite Facebook announcing the ban, they also said they would allow a video to stay up of the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., calling for volunteers for an army for Trump. The video was initially published in September. A Facebook representative, Monica Bickett, told reporters that Facebook's policies do not generally apply retroactively and that, quote, under the new policy, if that video were to be posted again, we would indeed be removing it. Democrats have responded to all of this by hiring voter protection directors in more than a dozen states. Facebook has also said it would reject ads that prematurely claim victory or suggest that official results are invalid.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. Fighting continued in the Nagorno-Karabakh region between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan's defense ministry said Armenian forces shelled settlements near Nagorno-Karabakh, causing casualties among the civilian population. Armenian authorities said Azerbaijan's army tried to launch an offensive in the southern direction of the contact line on Thursday morning. VOA's Heather Murdoch arrived in Armenia on Wednesday, and I spoke to her via Skype.
I'm in a small city called Goris, and it's about 90 kilometers from the war. We're here, first of all, it's a collection point for people who are fleeing the war. Families are coming out, coming to Goris. Some are staying, but most are moving on to the capital, Yerevan. And also, it is also a staging point for journalists and some aid workers to get into the war zone. So tomorrow, we might go inside. Today, we've been talking to refugees.
And in your conversations with refugees, what do they say? Because this is the largest escalation in fighting since the 1994 truce that ended the conflict between the two countries.
They are saying that this battle is very different from other skirmishes or conflicts since that truce. It's similar to the 90s, they say, but actually they think it's worse now than it was before. One fear people have is the weaponry is so advanced now, and, you know, with drones and different kinds of missiles. So they fear that it'll be more destructive than that because there are more weapons. There's also a lot of shelling in villages and towns and cities that more so than in the past. So civilians on the Armenia side are afraid that they're trying to clear out their areas from them.
There is some concern that this conflict could escalate and draw in regional powers. Besides the conflict itself and the immediate impact on the area, you know, those who this is affecting directly, what are their chief concerns?
Well, I mean, it is concerning, you know, from an outsider's point of view looking in, that international countries are considering or possibly going to join the fray, and this conflict could possibly become another proxy war like Syria and Libya, where Russia and Turkey are fighting between themselves on these lands. But on the ground, it's pretty clear there's a very growing nationalism or national pride on both sides. And what they're really concerned with is victory. People here in Armenia see this as an existential threat. They see the loss of this land as possibly a loss to their own identity as Armenian people, which is an ethnicity as well as a country. The people on the other side, as far as I know, looking in from here, see this land as illegally occupied territories that belongs to them and is their birthright. And many people that are Azerbaijani, their ancestors used to live in that land.
Heather Murdoch is VOA's Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief. U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday said that all U.S. troops in Afghanistan should be home by Christmas, just hours after his national security advisor said Washington would reduce his forces in Afghanistan to 2,500 by early next year. I spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb and began our conversation by asking her if this was an order or an aspiration.
Well, we are still trying to figure that out today, because every Pentagon or military official that I've tried to speak to has been referring me to the White House for this, which of course raises the question, was the Pentagon prepared for this announcement at all? And also the fact, like you said, that the National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, saying that we were going to be down to 2,500 troops in Afghanistan by early 2021, this is clearly very different from that. And will require a much shortened timeline. In fact, you know, I'd love to ask Pentagon officials if it's even possible, because there's so much, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of equipment alone in there. Is it possible to safely and securely withdraw? Because as experts and officials will tell you, the very last thing that you want to do is to leave U.S. military equipment around for enemies to pick up and to be able to use and to be able to study and analyze. So a lot of big questions remain from this, and we're just going to have to find out over the coming hours and days what this exactly means, or is it an aspiration that he is tweeting?
Speaking of the logistics involved, you also mentioned about the desire not to leave U.S. equipment behind. Officials have consistently said that the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan will always be based on the situation on the ground. What's the latest assessment by the Pentagon on the situation in Afghanistan, since there is still fighting taking place?
Well, I just spoke with the head of U.S. Central Command a few weeks ago, and he told myself and two other reporters that the U.S. was very comfortable going down to 4,500 by the late October-November timeframe, which we're approaching now, because he said that the U.S. would still be able to accomplish the core task that the U.S. came to Afghanistan to do, and that is to prevent another major terrorist attack from happening on U.S. soil or against our allies. And he said, he explained that the U.S. has shown more than ample goodwill, that was his words, to demonstrate that the U.S. does not want to be an occupying force in this country, but it does have a strategic interest, a vital interest, to prevent another attack and to be certain that these entities such as Al-Qaeda, which has been partnered with the Taliban, and ISIS can't be guests there to come and attack the United States.
One last question. We've been speaking about the U.S. on this side of the equation, but the troops are in Afghanistan. Has there been any reaction either from Afghan officials or the Taliban regarding the tweet?
So the Taliban came out and they were very pleased. They said that they welcomed the remarks. They considered it a positive step for the implementation of the agreement between the Taliban and the U.S. And they found it positive and good. And, you know, if you really sincerely trust the Taliban, then that's a positive step. The problem is a lot of people at the United States and the Afghan government and the U.S. military are kind of trusting but verifying. And that was why it was so important that the U.S. go down to 4,500 and then stay there and stick to conditions based, so this won't come back to haunt them potentially in the future.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. And coming up later.
So we're looking roughly 50 solutions over the next 10 years that can really turn the tide and really change the way we deal and tackle with environmental challenges. Then it would have been a success and it would have been worth it.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
About 13,000 years ago, as Earth was transitioning from a cold glacial climate to one that was much warmer, temperatures in the northern hemisphere suddenly plunged back down to near glacial conditions. The cooling event called the Younger Dryas is said to have ended as abruptly as it began about 11.5 thousand years ago, when quick global warming boosted temperatures to levels similar to what we have today. Scientists developed several theories to what caused the rapid cooling. Among them suggests 4-kilometer or larger sized fragments of an asteroid or comet impacted Earth about 12.8 thousand years ago. Scientists from Texas A&M and Baylor Universities released a new study that suggests the cooling event was caused by a series of powerful volcanic eruptions. The study authors say they found evidence to support their theory after studying ancient sediments taken from a cave in central Texas. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The European Commission has reached a deal for the antiviral drug remdesivir. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The EC says it's sealed a deal with pharmaceutical company Gilead to buy 500,000 treatment courses of remdesivir. No treatment has yet proved able to prevent serious illness after the coronavirus infection, but the antiviral drug has helped some COVID-19 patients recover faster. Remdesivir was approved as a treatment for the coronavirus by the Commission in July. Now, this agreement will allow countries to purchase the drug for immediate use and stockpiling needs. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
According to the United States Johns Hopkins University, there are over 26 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 and more than 1,055,000 deaths. The tracker also indicates that at least 25,250,000 people have recovered from the novel coronavirus after contracting it. In a new blow to the travel industry, Australia is warning its international borders are likely to stay closed because of COVID-19 restrictions until late next year. Phil Mercer reports four nationals were banned in March to help curb the spread of the coronavirus, and Australian citizens must get official permission to leave the country.
Last year, about 9 million overseas travellers arrived in Australia. The largest groups came from China, New Zealand, and the United States. The pandemic has seen those numbers collapse. COVID-19 has turned Australia into a fortress. Its borders were closed to foreign nationals in March, helping to contain the disease, but inflicting enormous economic harm. Australia is in a recession for the first time in three decades. The exclusion of overseas tourists and students intending to study in Australia has cost Australia billions of dollars in lost revenue. Australian citizens and permanent residents are allowed to fly home, but they must pay for mandatory hotel quarantine on their return. Tens of thousands of people are stranded in other countries because of strict quotas on those allowed into the quarantine system. Australians need official permission from the government to leave the country. Many of Australia's internal borders also have been closed to curb the spread of the virus. Most states and territories have managed to contain the virus, but reopening the country will take time, according to the Australian Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg.
Domestic borders are assumed to reopen around the end of this year. International travel, including by tourists and international students, is assumed to remain largely closed off until late next year and then gradually return over time. And a vaccine to be available around the end of 2021 is one of the assumptions in the budget.
Large-scale immigration, which has fueled prosperity in Australia, will only resume when international borders are reopened. By many global comparisons, Australia has mostly handled the pandemic well. It's recorded just over 27,000 coronavirus cases, and about 900 people have died. Geography has been a key part in its pandemic strategy. Australia is a huge island, and restricting international travel has helped to limit the spread of COVID-19. Safely reconnecting with the rest of the world promises to be a monumental challenge for the authorities here, though. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Opposition parties in Kyrgyzstan have failed to form a new government, as different groups argued over who would be the new prime minister after 3 days of political chaos in the Central Asian country. Mass protests erupted on Monday in the capital of Bishkek following a parliamentary election that appeared to show parties connected to the ruling elite winning. Opposition supporters seized several government buildings, looting some offices, and the Central Election Commission responded by nullifying Sunday's results. Russia said that Moscow was obliged by a security treaty to prevent a total breakdown in the country. Britain's Prince William has launched a multi-million dollar global prize aimed at solving some of the world's greatest environmental problems. Reuters' Adam Reed reports.
The Earthshot Prize will award five £1 million or $1.29 million prizes each year for the next 10 years. Entrants will be submitted in the categories of protecting and restoring nature, cleaner air, reviving oceans, waste reduction and climate change.
So we're looking roughly 50 solutions over the next 10 years that can really turn the tide and really change the way we deal and tackle with environmental challenges. Then it would have been a success and it would have been worth it.
The British royal family have been vocal campaigners on a host of environmental issues, and William feels it's his duty to continue that work to benefit future generations, including his own children.
So I really feel, from an emotional point of view as well, I think every parent, everyone wants to do the best for their children. And I think we have to have a decade of change, a decade of repairing the planet so that we can hand it on to the next generation and future generations and sustain the prosperity for their lives too.
Nominations open at the start of next month, and the first awards ceremony is scheduled for the autumn of next year.
That was Reuters reporter Adam Reed. The Nobel Prize for Literature was awarded this morning.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2020 is awarded to the American poet Louise Glück for her unmistakable poetic voice that with austere beauty makes individual existence universal.
The award comes after several years of controversy and scandal for the world's preeminent literary accolade. In 2018, the award was postponed after sex abuse allegations rocked the Swedish Academy and sparked a mass exodus of members. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S.-Colombia relationship is vital to the Western Hemisphere and its security and the freedom of all peoples in the region, said U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on a recent visit to Colombia. Colombia has played a critical role in caring for refugees from Venezuela during the difficult days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Your support of interim President Juan Guaido and a democratic transition for a sovereign Venezuela, free of malign influence from Cuba, from Russia, from Iran, is incredibly valued, stated Secretary Pompeo. The Colombian people desire a lasting and just peace in their nation. The violence on the part of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia dissidents, the National Liberation Army, or any other terrorist or criminal group is unacceptable and cannot be tolerated, nor can the actions of regimes like Maduro's, which provide safe haven, aid, and indeed comfort to those terrorists, said Secretary Pompeo. Colombia has demonstrated leadership on confronting the dangers posed by Hezbollah by designating it as a foreign terrorist organization. Such designations give governments the power to arrest members, freeze their assets, restrict their freedom of movement, and to make it harder to plot and carry out terrorist attacks. Putting maximum security on Iran and its Hezbollah proxies is essential to peace and security for free peoples everywhere, emphasized Secretary Pompeo. The United States and Colombia are also united in their fight against illegal narcotics, said Secretary Pompeo.
Colombian law enforcement, even in these difficult times, has stepped up cocaine interdiction and eradication. You manually cleared 57% more coca fields in 2019 than in the year prior in 2018. The U.S. is here to help by sharing resources, expertise, and we applaud the work that you have done.
The United States is Colombia's largest trading partner, accounting for 34% of Colombia's total trade. The U.S.-Colombia Trade Promotion Agreement aims to improve the investment environment, eliminate tariffs and other barriers to U.S. exports, expand trade, and promote economic growth for both countries. Secretary Pompeo announced that the U.S. will expand its private sector investment in rural Colombia, including through the U.S. Development Finance Corporation. He said, "We want to make sure there is a solution, an alternative to coca crops." Secretary Pompeo confirmed that the U.S. and Colombia are powerful forces for good in the Americas.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.